Welcome to the Midcoast Forum. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the Midcoast Forum, which is based in Rockport, Maine, where our membership of about 180 individuals meets monthly to hear a speaker on foreign policy. For further information, please see our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker Larry Wilkerson. Many of you heard Larry last year at the Camden Conference, where I would say for my money he was the standout speaker of the conference last year. Larry had served as Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff from 2002 to 2005. Before that, he'd been the Associate Director of the State Department's Policy Planning Staff. Prior to his term at State, he'd served 31 years in the United States Army, including 4 years as special assistant to General Colin Powell when Powell was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Larry currently teaches at the College of William and Mary, and he's also involved in a fascinating new effort at the New American Foundation called Smart Strategy Initiative, which is a long-term approach to preparing the United States for the middle of the 21st century, something we sorely need, as you can see from the provocative title of Larry's talk. Does it really matter who is the president? Larry Wilkerson.
Appreciate it. Thank you for that very kind introduction, and thank you all for having me back in Maine. It looks more like Maine this trip, or like my imagination says Maine should look in winter. When I was in Camden last at the conference, it was such a stellar blue sky, beautiful day that we were wandering around in shirt sleeves, and everyone was wondering where the snow was, because apparently you hadn't had much. We're having a late winter in Washington, I can assure you. We have had hardly any days below 32 degrees Fahrenheit until recently. And the thermometer plummeted to 18 on one morning, 19 on another morning, which isn't cold to you, I know. But we're expecting, according to the forecast, for our winter to linger all the way through mid-April, which is not uncommon if you look at the last 100 years of history, but these sorts of things, Hurricane Sandy, other things like that, are beginning to make people, even in Oklahoma and Texas, where I've recently been, question some of their spokespersons who constantly claim that planetary warming or climate change, or choose it as you will, is a hoax. When I would reveal to them that the United States Navy does not think it's a hoax and in fact is trying to marshal funds and put aside funds for a mission category called disaster assistance, humanitarian relief, and so forth, based on there being a 100-year storm every 10 years, they sort of look at me like, maybe there is something to this. If the Navy, the United States Navy, one of the most staid conservative forces on the face of the earth, is talking about climate change in that way, maybe there's something to it. And then you have the Congress, of course, rebuking the Secretary of the Navy for doing this and essentially telling him that he's out of his business, out of his mission set, if you will, and that he shouldn't be doing these sorts of things, least of all diverting money, therefore, which is insanity. And you walk over across the street and talk to Royal Dutch Shell, who possesses one of the best strategic think tanks on the face of the earth and constantly does things that just stun us in the Pentagon with regard to predicting alternative futures and so forth, usually having something to do with energy, as you might suspect, and you get a whole different picture. You get Shell, for example, in its blueprints and scramble scenario released to the public, telling you in private that they've put $5 billion U.S. aside or something equivalent in order to field people to protect their pipelines because this government and this military will be incapable of doing so. in the future that they envision, when everyone is scrambling for dwindling water and increasingly difficult to get a hold of because of competition and other interests, non-renewable fossil fuels, and also because of those fossil fuels, at least with current technology, damaging the environment in such a way when they're burned that someday countries' leaders will begin to wake up to that, probably after it may be a little bit too late, and do something about it. And so Shell is counting on the future being a little more anarchic and chaotic than perhaps the current White House is, and therefore planning for it. I missed the presentation, public presentation of their latest adaptation or iteration of their strategy. They did it at CNAS, the Center for New American Security, on the 28th of February, and I had another commitment, but I really wanted to make it because we're trying to get Shell involved. We've got ExxonMobil, we've got Chevron, we've got Total, we've got Elf, we've got a number of other energy companies involved. We're trying to get Royal Dutch Shell involved, too, in this project that Mac alluded to, the Smart Growth Initiative, because we know that energy is a major component of it. And that leads me to my subject today. Why would we be courting business at the corporate end, that is big business, multinationals like ExxonMobil, Goldman Sachs, other financial interest banks, entities, and so forth, rather than going to the United States government? Well, the reason is because the United States government is dysfunctional. And we understand that it's dysfunctional. So we've made a decision in this grand strategy project, if you will, that we're going to court business to get business to lead it. And we're going to do it to a certain extent, and are doing it, in the same way Lincoln, in the movie Lincoln, went after the Congress, recognizing fully the venality, the greed, the corporate malfeasance, and other things that exist today in a proportion that probably hasn't existed in this country since the robber baron days when Teddy Roosevelt took them on. And we're going to try to incentivize that greed and that venality to go in a different direction and therefore lead the country in that direction. And that's a very cynical way of saying what we're doing. I mean, I could be very optimistic and say we're trying to convince Rex Tillerson at ExxonMobil and other people in this environment that it's in their interest, economic and otherwise, to do sustainable things and not non-sustainable things, to deal in products that are at best, at worst, neutral to the environment and at best improving of that environment, to deal with things that still create profit, and we think profit in proportion to current activities and even beyond. And the even beyond is what is the hook that really catches them. But do it in a sustainable way. And to do it in accordance with what science, good hard science, is telling us is probably necessary out to 2035 in terms of adaptation, and that means it's done and you've got to adapt to it. Acidification of the oceans, for example. It's done. You got to adapt to it. You're going to eat jellyfish rather than cod? Maybe. So that's out to 2035, and then out to 2050 and on to 2075, it's amelioration and cessation. That is to say, we got to stop doing some of these things. Because if we take it beyond a certain point, then adaptation is no longer going to work. We're going to have to reduce the number of people on this planet, or we're going to have to do some other drastic things in order to have any chance of making it to the next century. It's that stark. And when you talk to the scientists, you understand it's that stark. When you talk to our Congress, that medium of dysfunctionality that probably reaches the zenith, you understand the nature of the problem. So we're, back to my point again, we're trying to get business, essentially, to lead this effort. That's whom we're courting, that's whom we're convincing, that's whom we're bringing in to be the major leadership of this particular initiative. Why do I say that the government is dysfunctional in any way that it hasn't been for the last 400 years? That is our colonial period, if you want to be generous, when we were part of the British Empire, or our national period, which is somewhat less than that. You've seen probably the movie Lincoln. Lincoln once said the House of Representatives was a place where spittoons and tobacco ruled. Lincoln is the man who opposed probably the most aggressive war in the history of this country, discounting maybe March 2003 in Iraq. History's verdict is still out on that, but it's not out on the Mexican War. Lincoln's the congressman who stood up and said, "Show me, Mr. President, show me the spot where Mexico invaded the United States." And Lincoln lost his job partly because of the popularity of that conflict, because we added vast territory to the United States because of that war. We would have added all of Mexico because of that war if Winfield Scott hadn't told the president, "You don't want it, Mr. President." So it was a very popular war. It was a very substantive aggression, if you will. But it was an aggression, and it was illegal as hell. And Lincoln, as I said, pronounced it such on the floor of the House of Representatives. Why is it different today? Well, there are a number of reasons why it's different. First of all, we were a growing power in the 1850s. We were a growing power in the 1890s when we replaced Britain by most hard statistics in terms of manufacturing and business acumen and power. It wasn't until the end of the British Empire, as it were, with the close of World War II, or maybe Suez in 56, that the British finally realized it. But in 1890, they'd been replaced. Took a while for them to realize it. Took a while for us to realize it. But we were building, at that time, arguably, the greatest human productive capacity the world had ever seen. It dwarfed anything in the past, no matter how you want to make it relative and compare it. It dwarfed Rome. In World War II, we unleashed that productive capacity in a way that was simply stunning. We fought on two major fronts, a world war, and supplied all of the United Nations, which is what we call them, the Allies, as we were fighting. I show my students at William & Mary a little film clip, grainy film clip, of one of the Russian commanders pulling into the rubble of Berlin. And I say, "Look, see that Soviet commander? See that flag on the Jeep? Know who made the Jeep? The United States of America. As they made most of the trucks in the Soviet army, which defeated 100 Wehrmacht divisions and really won the war in Europe. We were the arsenal for democracy. That was our strategy. And we unleashed a productive mechanism we didn't even know the capacity of, and it made 50,000 airplanes in a single year, 7,000 ships in a single year, and unbelievably supplied everyone in that war, from the Free French to the Soviets to the British and ourselves. And at the same time, fought almost single-handedly another enemy in the Pacific theater, Japan. Incredible. 50% of the world's GDP was produced by us in 1945. When we turned that incredible machine back to nylons, golf carts, golf clubs, automobiles, and so forth, we flooded the world with our productive capacity. And we maintained that kind of possession of the world's GDP for almost all of Eisenhower's administration. And Eisenhower never fell off a 90% tax rate on the richest 1% in the country. Never. Even though all of his Republican advisors, from John Foster Dulles to people in the budget business, tried to talk him out of it. Because Eisenhower knew, and he said often in an almost spiritual way, to those whom much is given, much is expected. What happened? And most importantly, what happened to Eisenhower's executive branch? At William & Mary, I asked my students to look at this every semester, 14 seminars, 3 hours each. And what they do is they look at what we call fateful decision-making. Fateful decision-making is defined as those decisions where a president sends young men and young women to die for state purposes, and something we often forget, to kill other people for state purposes. In my war, for example, we killed about 2.5 million Vietnamese. Ask yourself what the purpose of that 10-year-long war was. We killed 2.5 million Vietnamese. In Iraq, we have probably killed, by DOD estimates, 100,000 Iraqis. I suspect it's more like 250,000. In Afghanistan, I won't even venture a guess because the verdict's still out, even at DOD, on how many we've killed, or indirectly or directly. So we often forget that component of that fateful decision-making. Not just our men and women are risked, but they kill others. Through these fateful decisions that involve everything from Harry Truman's decision in 1950 to stand up to the North Korean invasion of the South to George Bush's decision in 2003, not documented in any national security decision document, by the way. Historians will love this. To invade Iraq. Covert and overt. We look at the overthrow of Mossadegh in 53. We look at the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala in 54. We look at Angola. We look at Chile. We look at Henry Kissinger and Nixon, in particular with regard to covert operations, where you often ask, what was the purpose? Why did we do this? Because Henry didn't like the situation? Because Richard Nixon didn't like the situation? Why did we, for example, cause the assassination? In many respects, cause the assassination, maybe even provided the weapon with which he was assassinated through the CIA, of René Schneider, the chief of staff of the Chilean military, who, in fact, was following the Constitution and refused to be bribed by the CIA. And so we had to take him out and put Pinochet in. So we look at all these decisions, and my students present them in three-hour case studies. Last hour is Q&A and critique. And boy, do I learn from my students. I tell them this at the beginning of every semester. I say, I'm going to learn as much from you as you learn from me, I guarantee you. They don't believe me for a minute. And then we come to the end, and we have a wrap-up session, and I think most of them believe me. I gain insights from them not only into their generation, into what they're thinking and what they're going to bring to this country, because they are the salvation of this country if we are to be saved, but I also gain insights into all this decision-making I'm talking about and how it comes about and how it has changed in the half century since 1947 when we passed the latest statutory rule, if you will, about how we do this. Created the CIA, created the Unified Armed Forces in the Pentagon, civilian secretary over it, and so forth. And what I see from that is pretty clear. It's several things. The first is the title of what I was going to speak about. It is that it doesn't matter who the president is. And it doesn't matter for a number of reasons. The first, and I could talk about it all day, but I won't linger on it because it's not what I came to talk about, but the first is the capture of the political process by corporate interest. Whether it's big pharmacy, big food, big oil or energy, you name it. It doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican, you now are so beholden to corporate interest in this country that you dare not defy them in any meaningful way. And anyone who thinks that is not the case has not been in the White House, in Foggy Bottom, or on the Hill recently with their eyes open. It is so easy for lobbyists now who in 1970 were about 130 strong and now are over 40,000 strong to buy influence on the Hill with money that it is almost the equivalent of a normal day of business. That's the first reason. But a president can, if he's courageous enough, and if he has an issue that he can take to the American people, I think still escape that. So it's got to be more than that. So the second thing I would point out is the centralization of all activity that matters, and fateful decisions are those that matter most, in the White House. And the absolute emasculation of the rest of the government. Particularly the State Department. The State Department doesn't matter anymore. The State Department can have anyone you want to put in there, Superman, as Secretary of State, and the White House will take his ankles, then his knees, then his thighs, and probably his whole body or her body away from them within the first year. The White House covets control of foreign and security policy, and the White House has control of foreign and security policy. I don't say that just because I served a man loyally for 10, 12 years, the last four of which were in the State Department, and I got to see it up close and personal. I say that because I was in the Defense Department for 31 years yelling at the State Department and stealing everything I could from them. And not realizing, stupid me, what I was doing as I was helping to build the instrument that now controls essentially U.S. foreign and security policy, the Pentagon. Think about it for a minute. Why would that not be the case if real power in government is resources, people and money, and DOD gets so much of both that Donald Rumsfeld looked at Colin Powell one day and said, I lose more money every year than you get. That year the GAO had said $40 billion could not be accounted for at the Pentagon. Our budget was around $28 billion. He was right. So how can you not be the most powerful entity within the federal structure when you get the bulk of the money? And ladies and gentlemen, for the last 10 or 12 years, you and I have been feeding the beast at a rate that surpasses any particular period in the Cold War, except that point where Harry Truman gave up on his $13 billion request and went to $55 billion almost overnight in order to begin containment and to fight in Korea. There is no other time since 1947 that we spent so much money on the military instrument as the last 10 or 11 years. It is unbelievable. And now you have proof of the pudding in the fact that military leaders in Washington are screaming about sequestration, automatic cuts, and so forth, what it's going to do to them. On the surface, they're right, because this is not the way to cut. This is stupidity. This is a lack of wisdom. But let me tell you, the Pentagon could lose $55 billion tomorrow morning and it wouldn't even know it had lost it. It is so awash in money. In 2010, we spent more money on the Pentagon in that single fiscal year than we did in any other year of the Cold War. Incredible. And the current cuts will only take us back to slightly above Cold War levels. You could take $1 trillion over the next 10 years out of the military budget, I should say national security budget, because it's much bigger than the military. It's Veterans Affairs. It's nuclear weapons at Department of Energy. It's Homeland Security now. My father called me up before he passed away, World War II veteran, and said, Larry, why did we create a Homeland Security Department? I thought we already had that, called Defense Department. Bush administration did this. Republicans. It created another Department of Government, which is so dysfunctional it can't find itself in a rainstorm. And the intelligence budget. The intelligence budget now topping $75 billion. I suspect fairly much higher than that because of black programs that still aren't reported. We are talking about $1.2 trillion in FY 2010. $1.2 trillion. That's not 4% of GDP. That's not 5% of GDP. That's more like about 7% of GDP. That's what we're spending on the national security instrument. I also include in that panoply the 150 account at State. It's like a tiny little ant crawling in amongst that budget. It's so small. So we need to balance that budget better, and we also need to cut it. And we could cut it, as I said, $1 trillion over the next 10 years, and it would be more efficient and more effective at the end of the day. But you have to do it wisely. Automatic cuts, sequestration is really stupid. But that's the second reason, and that is that we have militarized our foreign and security policy at the same time we centralized it in the White House. What does that do for you if you're president? That means that because of the dysfunctionality of the bureaucracy everywhere else, because of the ownership of corporate America of your major domestic policies, because of all these other things I've talked about, there's only one place you can turn to make your name in history. That's to the military instrument. You have no draft. You have a conscripted force. No, you don't have anybody to object. In fact, what you get from people who actually talk about this, which isn't too often, those people are paid. They're volunteers. They shouldn't be bitching. They shouldn't be complaining. I have no idea how many times I've heard that from the elite in Washington. Less than 1% of the country, you send them off to war. It's easy to do. You don't have any problem. Lockheed Martin, number one defense contractor in America, share price goes from $26 to $120. You go to war. This is what presidents can do, and they can do it with almost the ease of falling off a log. They don't even have to consult with Congress. First time in history, our history, President Obama went and led from behind with regard to Libya without any consultation with the Congress. Tried to cover it up, tried majorly to cover it up, but he didn't do a very good job. He did not consult with the Congress. I guarantee you, you're going to see more of that. Congress doesn't need to be consulted with. The executive can go to war. So this centralization of foreign security policy in the White House, ownership of much of the policy that matters domestically by corporate America, and the militarization of that foreign and security policy leads to, who cares who's in the White House? I ask my students, you've got this list, and this list is well archived. Lots. The further you go back to the Korean War, I can give you 100 references. Go back to 54, 53, I can give you 100 references. But I can't give you a lot of references other than instant history like Bob Woodward's, which stinks. On Obama's decision, for example, to surge in Afghanistan in December 2009. So you'll really be challenged if you take this. And I'll consider that in my evaluation of your presentation. I understand it'll be more subjective than analytical in the sense that you'll refer to history and documents and so forth. But I will also give you credit for being courageous, morally and otherwise. So sometimes they'll take these cases and they'll look at them. First question of the critique of the 1 December 2009 presentation, which was quite good, by the way. Do you think President Obama had any choice? Silence in the room. Isn't anyone going to answer the question? I said. Bottom line, 12 students said no. They're right. He didn't have any choice. First, he was trapped by his own campaign rhetoric. He had declared Afghanistan the real war and Iraq the wrong war. No matter how valid a statement that was, it was campaign rhetoric that tended to trap him. Just as John Kennedy's rhetoric about Cuba trapped him in 1960 when all of a sudden he got into the government and executed the Bay of Pigs and got egg all over his face and all over the nation's face. He had made campaign promises about doing something about Cuba. Obama had made campaign promises about Afghanistan being the real conflict. So in that sense, he had trapped himself. But you can get out of that. Look at Ronald Reagan. First term, he made 19 promises and fulfilled two. You can get out of that, especially if you're good at rhetoric. And Obama's exceptionally good at rhetoric. So what else trapped him? Well, think about this for a moment. He's been in the Senate for a couple of years. He's been a community organizer and so forth. I had a president I could tell you even more about, George W. Bush, in that regard. Didn't know anything about anything. And all of a sudden, he's in the Oval Office, and guess who comes in there? The Director of National Intelligence, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, backed up by that gargantuan organization over there that's been in the lead for the last 10 or 11 years in particular. All the other people who trap him are people who know. They're not thinking they might know, they know. John Brennan knows that drones are good. And when they get in there and they surround that president has no other alternative than to listen to them. And it doesn't matter what kind of inquisitive, incisive mind he does not have the experience. We have not had a president since Dwight Eisenhower, arguably, who had the experience, with the possible exception of H.W. Bush. And we threw H.W. Bush out after one term because he did so well. Figure that. So he's in there, and he's got these advisors who are telling him what to do. The most he can do is say to look as if he's confident and that he's making decisive moves is tweak it a bit. But he's not going to say to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to the DNI, to the other 16 heads of intelligence, to a host of other people who have captured him, he's not going to say, nah, I'm not going to do anything in Afghanistan. I decided I'm coming out because 10 years is enough and we've wasted enough blood and treasure already. Let's get out. Let's quit. Let's see what they can do for themselves or whatever. He's not going to do that. And that's the insight my students give me. That's 20-year-olds, graduate and undergraduate students, looking at all the evidence available and evaluating the state of their democratic federal republic. And incidentally, afterwards, going, Jesus, I'm worried about the future. And basically deciding that we've screwed things up majorly and that it is going to be one hell of a task for them to get them unscrewed. But, and this is why I keep teaching, being energetic and actually dynamic about suggesting ways to do it and ways they're going to participate in doing it. And many times that way is outside, and I try like heck to attract them inside the federal structure, and I succeed sometimes, but most of the time it's outside. It's the Peace Corps. William & Mary provides now, I think we fell to number two in terms of universities providing people for the Peace Corps. It's NGOs working like in the International Crisis Group or somewhere in the Beltway who are working on things just as I just mentioned New America Foundation is working on, despite the government, or in spite of the government in many respects. They want to go somewhere where they can make a difference. No matter how infinitesimal that difference may seem when they're 20, they want to go somewhere where they can make a difference. I sent a young lady to the NSA recently, 4-4 in Arabic, just a talented young lady. That's why the NSA hired her, I'm sure. Within 6 months, she's calling me and telling me she's going to break her contract. I said, don't do that, Alexa. Please don't do that because you'll ruin yourself for any further bureaucratic work in the federal bureaucracy. You simply won't be able to do anything. You'll be consigning yourself to never having an opportunity to contribute to your country again in a governmental sense, in a governance sense. So she said, I'll hang on for a while. Had lunch with her about 2 weeks ago. I said, how's it going? Are you going to work for Booz Allen Hamilton or SAIC or something like that? You know? No, I'm going to stay at the NSA. What'd you base your decision on? Leadership, she said. I finally found a good leader, and I'm working for him. And I'm now switched to Iran, and I'm working on Iran. I said, you don't speak Farsi? She said, oh, it's Arabic. She said, yeah, I understand it. She said, I'm getting classes in Farsi. I'm going to probably be able to get a PhD because they're going to fund me and so forth. Anyway, she was very excited. She's found a person at the NSA who is a decent individual who has brought her to an understanding that she can be in the NSA and not be corrupted and not be, you know, violating American civil liberties and so forth, which was part of her original concern. And so at least for the next 3 or 4 years, she's going to stay there. That's great. That's terrific. But most of the time, I can't convince my students to do that. They want to go somewhere else because they understand the same thing I'm talking about we understand at New America, and that is that you no longer can save the situation from the inside because you are so corrupted, contaminated, polluted, or so disenchanted so quickly you leave. Brings me back to one of the most outstanding young ladies we had on the 7th floor in the Foreign Service. She came in to see me one day when I was chief of staff, and she said, I'm leaving. I'm taking a job with Deloitte Touche, and I'm getting 3 times the money and so forth and so on, but that's not really the reason I'm leaving. I'm leaving because the Foreign Service stinks. And she began to tell me about her experience to that time. And taking her out of the lower echelons, if you will, and putting her on the 7th floor to serve the secretary was a recognition of the talent we saw in her early, an early promotion, if you will, even if it was only functional and not in grade, had not been enough to save her because she'd had such a bad experience for her first 3 years in the Foreign Service. And that bad experience involved all the things that any Foreign Service officer will tell you about, which is from I spent 2 years stamping visas and that was all I did, to I was in a huge embassy where I was just nothing and got no excitement and no sense of accomplishment out of it, and so I'm leaving. That's a story about the bureaucracy, even outside the things I've told you about the White House and the concentration of power and so forth and so on, that aids and abets the ability of the centralization and of the ability to the White House to simply say to the bureaucracy, I don't care what you think, carry this out. And that even adds to the dysfunctionality because, generally speaking, even low-level bureaucrats do not like that sort of thing to happen to them. So that increases the dysfunctionality as the bureaucrats at the lower level, unhappy with the way they've been charged, unhappy with the mission they're carrying out, unhappy with the way it was given to them, and unhappy with their state in general, rebel and do everything they possibly can to thwart the execution of that decision in an efficient and effective way. Dysfunctionality. Dysfunctionality of a nature that simply won't be able to muster itself in some positive way and meet the wicked challenges that we're confronting today. And I use that adjective not because it's a main adjective. I use that adjective because it has become commonplace in Washington amongst the cognoscenti to refer to the complex challenges that we confront today that are intertwined, that you can't even find the interstices to go into from time to time. That's the way we're describing them. There are challenges like, for example, agriculture, which we're looking at despite, in spite of the government. We tried to get the government interested. We realized quickly that it was absolutely a thankless task, a non-fruitful task. So how do you do it? Well, you don't, in this case, go after Monsanto and ConAgra and Archer Daniels Midland and all the other big food companies because they're part of the problem. What you do is you go around the world and you find out how other people, particularly the Chinese, are dealing with what we call the need to transition from industrial era agriculture to regenerative agriculture. And this involves everything from protecting the genetic diversity of seed stocks to how do you feed 9 billion people. And by the way, how do you feed 9 billion people of whom 2.5 billion in a generation have entered the middle class? Which is the projection between now and 2050. 9 billion people and 2.5 billion of them consuming like we consume. You need 9 planets. At present rates of consumption, linear projections, you need 9 planets. Now, most of these people are going to be in India and China, but they're across the globe. Those are the predominant populations. How do you deal with that? Well, you damn sure don't deal with it with Monsanto and ConAgra and ADM. You deal with it in a way, microcosmically, that Shanghai is dealing with it in China right now. You grow produce on rooftops, in greenhouses, in all manner of places so that you get about 60% of your produce in Shanghai from Shanghai. And you put the women, in Shanghai's case, in charge of maintaining the seed diversity, the genetic diversity, and so forth required so that that agriculture can regenerate itself from period to period. This is a real careful study we're doing of this because we're trying to figure out how to bring that back to our country and somehow meld it into the other parts of our strategy. Other parts of our strategy are things like housing. How do you change housing dramatically? I was just out in Oklahoma City talking to two Iranian-Americans who build about 500 units a year in the Oklahoma City area. And I was presenting this to them, and they were fascinated by it, which really intrigued me because they were fascinated because they saw the potential for greater profits. Instead of sprawl, you go to exurban and urban building, and you satisfy the democratic change that's taking place. For example, if I ask my seminars, do you want to own an automobile? No. Well, how do you want to get around? I want to get around by bicycle, light rail. If I want to go between metroplexes, I want to go on high-speed rail. Okay, 177 million Americans want that, according to our polls. Both at the beginning generations, the so-called millennials and so forth, all the way out to my generation, who are getting tired of a long commute or tired of maintaining a 7,000-square-foot McMansion 2 hours from the city. By the way, the Real Estate Association totals will be 35,000 McMansions rotting in another 10 years. No one to buy them. No one to buy them. As we go around to the metroplexes, Salt Lake City, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Portland, we've been around and people are beginning to recognize this because the market is showing it to them. And they're saying things like, ooh, these places are turning into drug havens because, you know, gangs move in on them and take over them and they exchange drugs at the bottom floor and sleep on the top floor or whatever. And we don't know what to do about it. But the market is also driving real change out there that we're trying to get our hands on through this project so that we can then hopefully get the lobbyists who now craft 90% of the legislation the Congress produces. Congress doesn't do it. Staff doesn't do it. Lobbyists do it. Whether it's health care or finance or whatever, lobbyists do it. So we're trying to get them to craft legislation that will incentivize what we're talking about. That is to say, changing zoning codes, changing things like sewage and water and transportation to the paradigm, to the scheme that we're putting down. And we're mapping every metroplex in America, about 200 of them. And we're designing ways to get into these metroplexes, both statutorily and in terms of what I would call the basic infrastructure, which is about $1.2 trillion worth of water, sewage, local transportation, and other things associated with the kind of housing that we want. Not sprawl post-World War II, but exurban and urban building. Why did we sprawl after World War II? It was a strategic decision. We knew that nukes could do a lot of damage to us, so we wanted to sprawl. We wanted to build highways. We saw, Eisenhower saw quite vividly, that you couldn't get across the United States from port to point, coast to coast very well, so we built the highways and everything. Well, it's a new time. It's a new age. And I'm of the old time, and I might say, yeah, I like the suburbs, and I don't mind the commute and everything. I don't say that. I hate the commute. But I understand this 177 million Americans coming up who want something different. And I also understand that our government is not going to do what our government did under Abraham Lincoln, for example, building the railroads, under Dwight Eisenhower, building the highways. Don't tell me government doesn't have anything to do in a market economy. That's stupidity. Government has everything to do in a market economy. Otherwise, you have chaos and anarchy. Otherwise, you have predatory capitalism that, as Marx said, yes, Karl Marx, will eat your lunch. And it is eating our lunch right now. It is eating 90% of America's lunch and making the other 10% incredibly fat. And the only way that changes is government, because they aren't going to change it. They love it. But government is dysfunctional. Doesn't matter who's at its head, it still is dysfunctional. So how do you get it to change? You get the demos to change it. You get the people to change it. And we think you lead with that which is our talent, our forte, has been since we started this country, business, commerce, trade. You convince the leaders of that world that the future is only sustainable, only manageable, only inheritable if we take care of our posterity. And the way we do that is we have to change majorly in the way we practice business, in the way we do things. Our tax system is a perfect example of this. For 20 years, we shifted taxing waste, not wealth. And just to show you how much waste there is in the United States, PricewaterhouseCoopers just did the analysis of our tax proposals and said we were wrong. We don't save a trillion, we save a trillion and a half. Plus balancing the budget annually and doing away with the deficit. Just by taxing waste. That's how colossal waste is in this country right now. Arguably, after 18 or 19, 20 years of incentivizing the reduction of this waste, we've got to shift back. And so we've got plans to change the tax pattern again. We're looking at things like value-added taxes, property taxes, you know, all the things that are usual in terms of revenue raising. But that just goes to show you how badly the government is doing with regard to even a fundamental aspect of revenue in this country, the tax system. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. You take a good hard look at the tax system, you want to just puke. And we've done this to ourselves, along with lobbyists, basically, who write the tax codes. What did Dick Cheney do when he was vice president? Powerful move. Absolutely powerful move. Dick Cheney picked lobbyists and or executives from the industries or functions being regulated and put them in the government to regulate them. Fisheries, mines, oil and gas, you name it. Dick Cheney put a lobbyist and or a CEO, CFO, or COO of that function into the regulatory system. And he left some 1,600 of them for Obama to deal with by transferring them from political appointee to civil service status. This is my party. This is the Republican Party. Fast destroying your republic. Fast destroying themselves, too. They don't change. Government is dysfunctional, and it doesn't matter who's at the helm. Caveat. If we had an electoral process and an Eisenhower, experience, and the means to get there, I'd change my view. Maybe. But since I don't see that anywhere, either on the electoral side or the individual character, moral courage side, I have to say government is dysfunctional and it doesn't matter who's at the helm. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. That was, I'm not sure the term is uplifting, though I think a lot of us here were happy to hear there was one good news, and that's not what your organization is doing over the next 40 years. It's those 10,000 mega mansions that are going to be rotting over the next decade. All right, we've got some questions for you. You said Obama, it's a great first question, was trapped when he decided to continue the Afghan war, the Afghan surge. Is he also going to be trapped into a war with Iran?
That's an excellent question. The question that would be on the lead of my mind at this moment is on the lead front of my mind almost every day. Not to be too blunt. I don't see how the president, he has two choices. He backs down, and this is assuming that he can't push it off, which is their current policy, push it off till the end of the second term and give it to Hillary. If he can't do that, he's either got to back down or he's got to bomb. There's no other choice. Right now, diplomacy, even with the encouraging signs we've seen from Almaty in Kazakhstan a few days ago and what might promise from technical talks and then another round of major talks, P5 plus one and so forth, and maybe bilateral talks too, that's being pretty much, I think that's pretty much in the wind right now, bilateral talks, U.S.-Iran. Even with all that, I see the diplomacy principally being sanctions. I do not see sanctions working. And even if it weren't the case, even if the administration, as seemed to be sort of indicated in Almaty, were willing to back off some sanctions in return for what they want from Iran, which I think the Iranians are willing to do. Even if that were the case, look at what the Congress is doing with the president behind his back, or you know, whatever you want to say. Three pieces of legislation just in the last 96 hours, one of which, sponsored by Lindsey Graham, now Senate Resolution 65, essentially says if Israel wants to go to war with Iran, then the United States will have its back. And it says it not in statutory language, it says it mostly in hortatory language, but nonetheless, the Iranians read it as the Congress is not in sync with the president. The Congress's role, mission in life vis-a-vis Iran is regime change. And as long as Tehran interprets that as being the real reason that we have this confrontation, they are not going to arrive at a point where they are willing to give up that decision at a minimum to have a latent capability and at a maximum to actually have a weapon. They simply aren't. And I don't blame them one bit. So where do we arrive if the president has only those two choices, back down or bomb? We arrive at a situation where he probably has to bomb, whether it's President Obama or President Clinton. And frankly, I'm more worried about President Clinton than I am President Obama because she was one of the most hawkish members of the administration vis-a-vis Iran. John Kerry's a little bit different, but look at what they've done to John Kerry already. John Kerry doesn't matter. That's one reason my party raised no objections to his being nominated as Secretary of Defense and confirmed therefore, or Secretary of State and confirmed therefore, and raised all kinds of objections to Chuck Hagel, because Chuck Hagel runs a department that has power. So you got to kind of emasculate him before he gets there if you're a Republican and you're interested in having your way. But John Kerry, 100-0. You don't need to do anything with John Kerry because he's innocuous. There is no power at stake. No power at all. Look at their discretionary budget after Egypt and Israel get their money. It's minuscule. It's so minuscule that when people look at me and say, we spend too much money on foreign aid, I say, you're crazy. You don't know the facts. We spend less money on foreign aid if you discount private philanthropy, which is quite extensive, I'll admit. But if you discount private philanthropy, we spend less money on foreign aid than almost any other country in the world. We don't waste money on foreign aid. Jesse Helms was an idiot. You know, Jesse Helms eviscerated the State Department. Jesse Helms made it his personal vendetta to take the State Department down. He incorporated ACTA and USIA into the State Department, a personal feat on his part. He ruined U.S. public diplomacy when he incorporated USIA in the State Department. Public diplomacy gets no hearing today. You know what public diplomacy is for the United States of America? It's a four-star admiral general walking into Tokyo to the prime minister or into Saudi Arabia and Riyadh to the king or wherever, because that's your diplomat in the world today, is a four-star soldier, sailor, airman, or marine. The undersecretary of state, the assistant secretary of state, is lucky if he can get an audience. It's insanity. We are the new Rome. Caesar hasn't come across the Rubicon with his legion yet, but he's posed. And it's going to be a lot more sophisticated and subtle than something like that. It won't be legions taking over the country. Indeed, many would say, we already got it. The creation of Africa Command, AFRICOM, is a good example. What the hell does the military have to do with Africa? That's USAID. That's the Millennium Challenge Corporation. That's anything but the military. Now the military is the lead activity in the continent that is the biggest basket case in this future I was talking about on the face of the earth, so much so that millions of them may be immigrating soon. Stand by. And that's the reason this is a national security challenge, as well as a human rights, human dignity, people challenge. These people are not going to sit down and starve to death while we watch. They're going to migrate, and they're going to migrate everywhere they can possibly migrate, whether it's displacement from Syria and a civil war, Iraq and an invasion, or whatever. You're going to have these huge population movements across the globe. And if you want to check something out other than rats, lice, and history, you know, the real things that motivate major change in human history, check migrations out. Check massive movements of people out. That's what we're looking at if we don't get a handle on some of these wicked challenges in the next 10 to 15 years.
We've got a couple of questions here that are sort of a follow-up to your comments about the State Department, and I'll read them both. The first one is, do you think Secretary of State Kerry is aware of how impotent state is? If so, why would he take the job? If not, why not? That's the first one.
That's an excellent question, too, and it's a question that I asked myself several times and even asked my old boss, Colin Powell. Why not take the Defense Department where you're really powerful rather than the State Department where you're almost without power? Because I want to change that. Good answer. Probably John Kerry's answer, too. Guess what? He isn't going to change it.
Well,
Colin Powell didn't change it.
That was the other question. How can a public campaign be mounted to reverse this trend in state? How can the Foreign Service be revitalized and made relevant? Would Colin Powell take on a lead role in such advocacy?
If it were presented to him in such a way that he thought, and this is always his criteria, timely, possible, and had a 60% at least chance of success. that's kind of his, if you've read his latest book, he sort of goes into this, but he once came up to me and he said, come here a minute. And he went to what was then a green board and he took some white chalk. This was at Forces Command headquarters at Fort McPherson in Atlanta, Georgia, and he drew a line. And he put a thing here, a thing here, continuum, if you will. And he said, this is how I make decisions. You see, right here, he also put a line in the center, which was 50%, he said. He said, right here, you've got 10% information, but you're really quick. You're probably going to make a bad decision. You're going to make it decisively and quickly, but you're going to make a bad decision. Right here in the middle, you've got time passed, maybe not too much affecting your decision. You can still make it. and you've got 50% of the information, so you got about a 50-50 chance. I don't like those odds, he said. Out here at 60%, you've reached the cusp of time where you've got to make the decision, but you've got 60% of the data you need to make it. Make it. That's the way he operates. So if you could convince him, yes.
Yeah. Can you define more clearly what you mean by waste in the context of the $1 billion, $1.5 billion tax savings? And this is also related to your project. How will working with leaders of business, universities, et cetera, change a system in which 90% are feeding 10% by a dysfunctional tax system?
Yeah. I think the answer to the first part is, and I'm no expert on this, you'd have to talk to some of our scientists, but from what the briefings I've gotten and so forth, the majority of this waste is in the parts per million that are going into the atmosphere. That is like Virginia Dominion and their coal-fired power plants and other, I say Virginia Dominion because that's the one I'm most familiar with in Virginia. It's everything that's putting the gases, principally carbon dioxide, but others too, into the atmosphere that are causing us to have this expectation that by 2035 we may be, and that's come down considerably in the last decade. That is to say, it was out there around 2060, then 2050, and so forth. May even come closer, where we no longer can adapt, or adaptation becomes the only thing we can do. That is, we can't ameliorate. We can't change the situation. I've seen one scenario, for example, that says if the waste in that regard continues at that level, we will be, by 2075, at a point where the arable land left on the planet will only feed roughly 400 to 500 million people. So where do you want to put those people? You know, where do you want them to live? And my question to this particular team of scientists was, where do you bury the other 8.5 million? Isn't that sort of a difficult challenge there, burying the other 8.5 million? These scientists are not very passionate about the way they deal with this. It's all just cold, hard facts, which is, that's understandable and admirable in a sense, and certainly acceptable, because when you get passion like Jim Hansen at NASA, you get people saying, well, that's a hoax. That's a hoax, you know. Don't give me that stuff. Don't show me that map of Florida not being there. Don't show me that map of Bangladesh being gone. Don't show me that map of, people forget. They absolutely block out of their mind that it doesn't matter whether we're contributing to this or not, it's happening. I think we're contributing to it and therefore accelerating it, but it's happening. The planet for the last 1,000 years has been very hospitable to human life. In the next 1,000 years, it probably won't be that hospitable. So we've got to do some things about it if we want to continue to stay here. And some of my Republican colleagues say, well, what, we go to Mars, or we go to Venus, or we go somewhere else. Well, that's an alternative, but show me the methodology and the technology, and the means to do it by this time. So the biggest part of that waste is that. But there is an incredible amount of waste in things like energy usage. For example, I'm heavily invested in Virginia Dominion Electric Power because they're the best return on my money. I buy their shares every time I can get a hold of it. And yet I know that they are distributing electricity at the peak of our technological capability, such as it is construed and constructed today, almost 90-100% of the time. And I know that is so wasteful, it's incredible. In fact, I know that that power delivered over the lines that come to my house is wasting about 75% of that power while it delivers about 25% to me because of the way it's constructed, generated, and delivered. So I know that if I had instead, as China is working very, very aggressively on right now, a community of, say, 65 homes, in my townhome complex, it would be 165, and I have a tiny little generator in the middle of that community that I can deliver with 90% efficiency, the same power over the same time frame with a lot greater dependability, because I can run out there and fix that thing with my little maintenance team, whereas Virginia Power takes a week to get the power back up after a big win or whatever. I can make it incredibly more efficient and save a ton of money. Multiply that by all the counties and precincts and parishes in the United States, by all the energy delivery means that we have, all of which are incredibly inefficient, the water that we waste. New York City, We saw the stats. We had a briefing from Bloomberg's team. New York City wastes enough water every day to supply Atlanta. Atlanta wastes enough water every day to supply Frederick, Maryland. We waste incredible amounts of water, and we don't have to. The technology exists. The systems are out there. If we can incentivize the people to make them and sell them and the people to buy them, they're there. This technology is not pie in the sky. It already exists. It's like cars. Would you tell me, Mac, you're getting 50 miles with your Prius?
Yeah.
We could have been getting 50 miles per gallon 30 years ago. We have done so much damage to the Saudis' perception of the future that the Saudis are sitting down every day and calculating what the price of gas, oil, whatever can be in order not to incentivize any more movement. One of the ministers' people, oil ministers' people, told me, we figure about $118 for West Texas Intermediate or Brent crude or whatever the benchmark is you're referring to, we figure that is what we need to maintain the patronage level of our princes and people so we don't get a revolution. But we figure $87 a barrel is what, above that, is what incentivizes alternative energy research. So we're really hoist. We don't know what to do because the price keeps going up and the price stays above the 87, so we know we're incentivizing all these alternatives. We probably don't have a very, very prospective future. That's probably pretty rational if the rest of the world is rational. But the Saudis know the rest of the world is not rational. And what do you do in North Dakota? You frack. 8,000 mines in North Dakota already, 32,000 planned. North Dakota's unemployment is below 3%. Economy's booming, got prostitution, gambling, murder all over the place. Don't care. It's 49 again in California. It's gold rush days. Things are great in North Dakota. But what are they doing to the geologic structure beneath that state? What are any of us doing to the geologic structure beneath our territory when we frack? We don't know. Scientists will tell you who aren't on the payroll of the oil and gas industry that we don't know. We simply don't know. So why are we doing this so wholesalely if we don't know? I'll tell you why. Profit. Profit in restoring the economy in places. Oklahoma City, unemployment around 3%. Unemployment around 3%, oil and gas booming. Unemployment among veterans, 20%. Suicide rate in the Army and Marine Corps off the charts. Who cares? Oil and gas booming. These are not decisions, these are not outcomes that the American people are being consulted about. Unless you happen to be living on a place where they're fracking and all of a sudden you turn on your gas or your tap in the kitchen and you get a flame out of it rather than water. I mean, if you live in Pennsylvania, you know all about that. So these are things that need to be looked at by a collective, need to be exposed, need to be transparent, need to have decisions made about them that are in your good, in the prospect of making sure your grandchildren and my grandchildren and your children and others have a decent life. What the preamble to the Constitution says, and our posterity, we have forgotten about our posterity. And I don't think you can get to a decent outlook for that future until you start recognizing some of these wicked challenges and you start making some moves to meet them. And one of the, bring full circle here, one of the things we're saying is you've got to stop this waste. You've got to stop the waste, whether it's cars or whether it's highways or whether it's airplanes. Airplanes, technology in airplanes has just gone off the charts lately. I mean, we're getting the kind of fuel consumption out of huge, thrusting Rolls Royces and GEs and Pratt & Whitney's and so forth now that, you know, was not even conceived of 20 years ago. That's what I'm talking about, putting the very best technology into practice and looking for more and stopping waste while you're doing it. And this is the waste in this country. If you look at the charts that I've looked at and listen to the briefings that I've listened to, and I hurt because I'm not expert enough to tell you some of this data in a way that analytically is satisfying. But it is colossal, what we're doing. Water, fuel, energy in general, the waste that we have in this country. And then put on top of that that we're 6% of the population and we're using about a third now. of the energy and resources. How would you feel about that if you lived in Uganda and you knew it? Or if you lived in Egypt and you knew it? Or if you lived in Iran and you knew it and you were suffering the sanctions that we have on Iran right now? That we're consuming far more than our percentage of population would dictate we consume in this world that is becoming very difficult to find that to consume, and that we're using the military essentially to protect that. I mean, you can say, as my father used to say, good Republican he was, my father would say, we deserve it. We're better. Sometimes in my family, someone would say, we're white. Teddy Roosevelt, one of the biggest racists on the face of the earth. Go back and read some of the things that Teddy wrote and said. Racist, little brown people. We'll take care of the little brown people in the Philippines. Doesn't matter if you waterboard them and murder them in a trench. Murdered 1,000 in a trench one day, and he congratulated the brigadier general who did it. This is not something new in American history. This is something that's been here for a long time. So my father would say, tough. You know, we're better than they are. Dick Cheney said, I don't care if you torture an Iranian, but an Iranian better not torture an American. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think that's going to wash in the world anymore. I think the future is collaboration, cooperation, and so forth at whatever level, or we are going to buy it. So I don't buy that anymore. So I can put myself in the shoes of that Ugandan or that Botswanan or that Iranian or whatever and say, my God, why are we putting up with this? And the theory of international relations is still pretty sound. It says when that happens and you don't have overwhelming power to assure that you can maintain the top of the mountain, the rest of the world will move to balance you and ultimately defeat you. Recently, CELAC, the organization in South America designed to do away with the OAS, basically our organization, elected Raul Castro as its head for a year. That's the message. The only two countries they prohibited from joining CELAC were the United States of America, El Coloso del Norte, as they say down there, and Canada. I asked the question of one Cuban, why did you eliminate Canada? Canada's usually got a pretty decent foreign policy, too close to the United States. That's the future. Brazil, up-and-coming country. I was in a cab in Sao Paulo. I asked the cabbie, spoke a little bit of English. I don't speak Portuguese, but between my English and Spanish and his English, we got along. He turned to me as we stopped at a stop. By the way, he was driving a General Motors car. And when he stopped at a red light, he looked over and he said to me, when you have a president leave office, 82% in the polls. That's how Lula left office, 82% in the polls. And by the way, Dilma Rousseff is not much different from Lula, except she's not as charismatic. That's going to be 16 years, probably, of good leadership for Brazil. Brazil is an up-and-coming country that will be a major competitor for us in the future, and we don't even know it.
We always try to end this on a happy note, and I don't think that was one. And we don't have time for any more questions. The last question I was going to ask you, I don't think this was going to elicit much optimism either. Can we expect Congress to help steer us out of the problems that we're in? I won't ask you to do that one.
You know, I'm going to end on a positive note, because this is the way my students always end it with me. The only factor that is still a critical component of our democratic federal republic is you, the American people. You know, there's a part, my wife says, don't say this, Larry, the FBI is listening. There's a part in our Declaration of Independence, I wish I could quote it. Every time I try to memorize it, I get so tears in my eyes. There's a part in there that essentially says, when in the affairs of men and women, a government really isn't working, then the people have the right to fix it. Now, Thomas Jefferson would say by blood if necessary. Others would say by other means, at least as a last resort, maybe blood. I would submit to you that the last resort might come quicker than we think if we continue this incredible wealth disparity in this country. One of the congressmen who was involved in passing the amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act 2 years ago, which essentially eliminated the restriction on the armed forces participating in domestic law enforcement, which hasn't been done since Reconstruction, told me in confidence, so I won't tell you his name, Republican, the reason it passed overwhelmingly in both bodies of the Congress was because they were afraid of Occupy Wall Street. They were afraid that someone was going to march on the Capitol, and they wanted the military to be able to stop that. So I don't discount that entirely, but what I do say with some belief in its veracity and in your ability and others' ability to do it is the American people have been apathetic, and you need to stop being apathetic and take your damn government back.
Larry.
And one more word. You sent a man to Congress, Angus King, and that's the kind of person who needs to be in the Congress of the United States to lead to the...
That we agree with you on.